long day. I got a lot to say. It feels like I'm carrying a two-ton weight. I go see a friend.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Patrick Winslow.
And I am Father Matthew Kauth.
And we are speaking from the rooftop.
A podcast brought to you by Tan Books, in which we invite you to join our conversation out here in the open air,
where we look out upon the world around us from the rooftop of the church and share with you what we see.
Makes me wanna scream from the rooftop to the screen till I know.
Well, hey there.
Well, greetings. How are you?
I'm fine. Do we explain that we are not on a rooftop, but we're on the top
kind
of something?
Are. About as high as it gets.
Yeah.
Overlooking a lake and some
in the Smoky Mountains.
All the priests are on retreat. And so we thought we'd take this opportunity, since we're actually together, to do a recording.
Yes. And we do see what looks to be like smoke, albeit clouds, nestling over the top of the mountains.
Oh, it's lovely.
With a beautiful, small, a beautiful lake down below us, and we sit on a third level balcony. I think somebody's playing a guitar in the background down there.
Yep, anything could happen.
Oh my gosh.
I'm a priest here.
So. It's just perfectly quaint. Well, let's see if we can kind of harness our attention and focus on something. You know, I was just about to say to you that on my way here, as I was driving for several hours, I had some ideas that I thought, yeah, this would be nice to talk about. And of course, my ability to recall is just ridiculously, without effect.
Anemic.
Yeah, without real effect. Although there is something that I did think about. And as most of these things are, when you think about them the first time, they seem really interesting and illuminating, and then later you go back to them, you're like, why did I find that so interesting? Mm. But in any event, there was something I was thinking about. It was about, you know, living life in the church. And of course, we both have a long experience in living life in the church. I would say that we probably just went headlong into it. You coming out of high school and a little bit of college, jumping right in to full-time give my life to the church in the form of going to the seminary. I had a few more years of college, but nonetheless did the same thing. Jumped right in headlong. Neither of us really had a long duration of living life as sort of an active parishioner, where you get involved and there's no sense that every day is going to be in the life of the church, but in the sense that you have a vocation or something. All right, it's a long setup. But most people live their life in the church by getting involved. You know, they're married, they have families, or maybe it's before they ever get married, but they get involved. They do something at church and they start to take on responsibilities and different activities. And above all, they've engaged, even before they've done this, their interior life, which is, you know, the real engine behind it all. So whether it's that or whether it's the way we live our life in the church, which is throughout a vocation, it seems to me that there are some pitfalls, and that those pitfalls are pretty common. And I think you'll relate to it because we get caught up into a lot of administration. But it seems to me, using the language of Aristotle and St. Thomas on causalities, that we get really pulled in to a lot of the efficient causalities. We get pulled in to the things that weren't the causalities that got us there. So when we started, we wanted to know the first cause of everything. We wanted to know the final cause, you know, the purpose of all things. And then, of course, we start getting involved because we're driven by these things. And then we get pulled into all of these middle causes, efficient causes of having the church operate and function, and from fundraising to logistics to organization to managing people. And it seems to me that I could look back in the course of my life and see how that started to come on strong, even early on, in seminary, how these things start to dominate, and how the eternal horizon fades, and how, you know, the initial intention and purpose for which we're the intentions that move us and the purposes for which we're driving to understand, they start to recede because we get so caught up in the immediate moment. Any thoughts? Because I do think that, you know, maybe it's too much of a stretch to see it, you know, in terms of causalities, but that's just how I was thinking about it at the time.
You know, it used to be the case that when I would use these kinds of terms, you would stop and say, okay, for real people, let's use real words. And this is what this means. This is what that means. But, you know, he's finally converted. He's finally began to study Aristotle and Thomas, which is, you know, the only way one ever has any real wisdom. So, yeah, I do have a lot of thoughts.
But you get my point. Am I articulating it, or am I just dancing around?
So
it?
Imagine. Let's just break it down a little bit in terms of like efficient causality. So give an example, if you will, for the folks about the different kinds of causes. And so this is Aristotle saying, whenever we ask questions about anything, we ask basic questions that are very consistent. And the first question we ask about anything is why, right? So the question of end or intention, like why is this the case? Or how is this the case? Or out of what is this the case? Or by whom is this the case? So whenever, if we have, for example, if I pull a rabbit out of my hat, you're going to ask the question, how did he do that? You're not going to assume that the rabbit, it's actually magically coming out of my hat. You begin to ask questions of everything you encounter in life. And so when you're using the word efficient causality, I think it's a good way to describe it as a kind of middle cause, in the sense that your end is your, as the old adage goes in Aristotle, that everything is first in intention and last in execution, meaning that that's where I want. That's my end, my final cause, which we don't think about that as a cause anymore, but it is. It's what moves everything. Like what right. tips the scales between acting and not acting. Yeah, I could go pick up food and put it in my mouth, but it's because I want food as an end.
Right.
I'm hungry.
Or I make a table, and in the end, I want a place to eat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the big why.
It's the big why. It gets me moving.
Right.
Whereas efficient causes are just those things that actually are the means by which something is done.
Or comes about.
And so nothing happens without them.
Yeah.
But it pursuant to your overall consideration, when we were in seminary, you know, in large part we got, or even before seminary, we got to enjoy, to some degree, the labors of everyone else.
Yeah.
You and I have talked many times about what it was like to go into a church when we had no responsibility for it.
But we knew there were priests. We knew that it was yep. clean. We yep. knew that it was beautiful. We
sanctuary
knew
the sacrament candles was burning. There. Yep.
And
we could just walk in and take and enjoy it.
And just, yeah, of course, this is exactly how it's supposed to be.
Yep.
As though it eternally remained that way.
And then all of a sudden you get the consideration by God's grace that I want to be the one to tend that flame. Like I want to do my part. I want to respond to the grace that's been given to us through the crucifixion and death and resurrection of Christ. But that also means that you are responsible for it. I suppose it's no different than the way in which you and I get to enjoy other people's families.
Right.
Or our nephews and nieces.
Right.
Or whatever. It's delightful.
We don't do the hard work.
We don't do any of the hard work.
No, we don't.
Any of the hard work. We just get to enjoy.
Yeah.
And my sister always, you know, chastises me because I won't change diapers of my nephews.
Yeah.
And I used to change her diapers years
right.
ago. I have no problem actually changing a diaper, but now it's a categorically different thing. Because now I am uncle. And
right.
uncles are there for the purposes of having fun.
Yes.
And not changing diapers. That's a parent job. So you all don't have to deal with the parish council and I don't change diapers.
That's right, exactly.
But I suppose it's that way in anything, that you lose sight of the end for the means. And
It becomes an illusion of an end.
Yeah, it does.
Like we get caught in these petty battles.
As if these things are the important things.
You know, I remember, I think I've mentioned this before, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but I do remember early on in my priesthood walking into a sacristy where a 70-year-old someone and an 80-year-old man this man and woman were just arguing about something, where something was placed in the sacristy, or who got to do what, who got to light the candles or put them out. It was the most silly, childish thing. And here I am, you know, my late 20s, newly ordained priest walking in, and I'm uncomfortable calling these older people by their first names, because my generation, it was Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. And meanwhile, they turn to me like children who are in a dispute and call me father, looking for a resolution. And it just threw me for a loop. And I thought, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, I'm uncomfortable calling you by your first names. And now you approach me like toddlers, disputing about something small. But to get to the point, why were they disputing about something small? Why did these small things become so important? Why did they become so big? And I do think that that speaks to, you know, some of the challenges in living a communal life, living in a true communion in the life of the church, that we do bicker about small things. I mean, this happens, of course, in families, right? You know.
Yeah, sorry, I just got to. You remember, obviously, we're not going to name names here, but many years ago.
Is it Father Gober? If it is Father Gober, I want to name names.
No. I mean, this is. Okay. He doesn't do any work.
So. Well, that's true.
No, many years ago, you and I were together, and there was a particular sacristan, and, you know, just doing her job.
Oh, yes.
But could not do her job. Like, no matter how many times we said, please don't turn the lights. Oh. Like 2 hours before the mass, 2 hours before the morning mass. Just leave the lights off. We're just in here praying.
Yeah.
Lights have to go on. The tabernacle has to be checked. The doors have to be opened. Like, she had to do all these things. And I get it. You know, from her perspective, it's kind of like what we're talking about here. People want to participate in the church.
Yeah.
And they get these tasks.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself at a different parish recently that I was just there to pray. I just stopped in to pray. And they had mass in like 2 hours. And it was a daily mass, right?
Wow.
And hour before.
Oh, you're saying the mass took 2 hours long.
No.
You're saying
no.
This was 2 hours from the time you got there, they were having a daily mass.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
No. So about an hour before, again, the sacrist comes in very dutifully. And she never stopped until the mass began. About 30 seconds before mass began, she kneels down to say her prayers.
Yeah.
And I get it. Yeah. She's taking upon herself, this is what I do for God. This is how I assist the church. But I couldn't help but think to myself, seeing myself to some degree in some of that kind of behavior, all right, you got 30 seconds of his attention.
Right.
And you did all kinds of great things for him. But, you know, again, I don't want to reduce it to Mary's chosen the better part, because both need to be done. But at the same time, she sees herself as an efficient cause to make sure everything runs.
That's
thank God, we need them.
Right, and it can eclipse the greater purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's basically a Father Gober holy hour that we were describing. I had to do it. I mean,
well, he looks you, for things
you,
to
you cued it, that's true.
Oh, man.
You cued it right up. I couldn't,
I'm
I had
sorry.
To hit, I had to
I didn't
hit
mean
that.
To.
No, but it's true. And I think, you know, you and I both deal with a lot of conflict. Because where there are people, there's conflict. We deal with a lot of friction that comes about by practical realities. We deal with material needs, whether it's resources coming in or how they're expended, keeping that all in check. And these are all things that serve a greater purpose. I mean, in a certain way, they're like efficient causes. They facilitate, but they can become so all-consuming. It's the same thing for family life, you know. Yeah. You know, at some point, the paycheck could seem as the goal.
Yeah.
And you forgot why the paycheck was important.
Because it's so hard. It's so hard to provide.
Right.
To keep a roof over people's heads, to think about the future, to take them to soccer practice, whatever.
Or you think, you know, I'm going to save all this money to do this big, you know, to do a big vacation or to put in a pool in the backyard, right? And then it becomes about the pool. And it doesn't matter how many people you run over along the way, including your own kids, something, because the final end was eclipsed.
Well, here's a good way to think about this. If you and I were driving back to Charlotte, let's say, and obviously we want to get to Charlotte because Charlotte is home, and we're traveling there, neither of us are going to think about driving at all.
Yeah.
We're going to think about 1,000 different things and probably have 15 of these conversations on the way home.
Right.
And
the portion of my brain that is in the subconscious drives.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so St. Thomas calls it a virtual intention. Because you've made the intention beforehand to drive.
And a part of me is carrying it.
And you have a habitual capacity to do so.
Yeah.
So it just carries it out. Now, if something gets in your way on the road, or a car swerves or something, all of a sudden you're intentionally driving again. But I don't need to think about those things when I'm doing them.
Yeah.
That's part of the beauty. And maybe one way to consider, whether it's for family or for us, is that when the end is no longer infusing the means, when the end is no longer saturating the present as the thing that we're looking for, and which actually, quote unquote, drives us to Charlotte, then why are we doing it?
You have to go back. This is where I think we're touching on an important element of a prayer life.
Yeah.
Because when one prays, we pray in such a way that we are addressing our final end. We are addressing that for which we are made. We are addressing, you know, what this life is all about.
Yeah.
And it's not just, as some people might think of prayer, as a laundry list of petitions, but rather really situating yourself in this relationship that is about your very existence, your very purpose, your very identity, and what brings you into proper and right fulfillment. And all the different ways, of course, in which we try to fulfill ourselves that doesn't work. And so we kind of suss those things out in our prayer life too, saying, all right, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for this. I'm sorry for that. Because in the end, the reason why I did all these things and I'm sorry for, it sounds like a train is about to run through the
lake.
I've
never heard a train here before.
Good. Is that a train?
And this one day we've seen and heard a train and sirens, which we haven't had
so much
in the last
for the peace of the Smoky Mountains.
It looks like a cool old train, though.
Wait, do you see it?
Yeah, I see it over there.
Oh, my. That's moving about 2 miles an hour.
Yeah, it sounds like it, too.
It sounds like it's burrowing through the earth. I mean, there we go.
Yeah, well, we're up pretty high, so.
Yeah.
It's echoing off the mountains and things.
But if it lost sight of its end,
there you go.
The fact that it has the rails is like a virtual intention.
Yeah.
That it can keep going. But it might run out of steam.
Oh, there you go.
Right?
Way to twist this thing into something.
Because why keep going?
Why keep going?
If you run out of steam. This can happen in the family life. This can happen, as I was saying, in our own life. When we go to a prayer, part of the fruits and the benefits of praying is to resituate ourselves, reorient ourselves, so that we have a sense of that greater purpose and horizon.
Yes.
So as a practical measure, if anyone listening is finding themselves struggling with the drudgery of life, well, that might be a sign that you're drowning in all these efficient causes. You're drowning in all of these things that you have to take care of.
Keeping the plates moving, keeping the balls in the air.
Without taking stock into why you do it, which is why so often, whether it's in a book or in a film or in a poem, someone looks at a child, you know, an older person who's feeling the drudgery and the cynicism of life, looks at a child, finds inspiration. Because you see in them a why. Like you can find a purpose. This is why I wake up. This is why, this is what I do. But even then, another finite person can't be the ultimate why.
Sure.
Right. But it's a good start because you look at the other person, you say, well, their life can't be constituted just by finding another person to look at and make them their why for life. Right.
Mm.
And you say, you know, they were made for something much higher. And sometimes that's how we begin our own faith.
Yeah.
You know, children often, you know, parents who become parents for the first time look at their children and they're like, all right, you know, I could muster the drudgery. I can put off these eternal questions for myself, but I can't do it for them.
Yeah.
And so it forces them to reconsider things, and they come back and have their children baptized, and they start getting intrigued in their own. Anyway.
Yeah. I've been
muddling along here, so feel free to chime in and sharpen any points.
No, I just that kind of settles upon the thing we've said before, that so often the case that parents will do for their children what they wouldn't do for themselves, which is the same for the priest, right? There's some times in which I would drag myself to church early to pray and make sure that I had that time before the parishioners got there, in some ways for them. Like, you know, I wouldn't have gone for myself early or something. Times you're pushed by those you love and you serve. But I think back to, you know, I've not been a parish priest in a long time, but one of the things that always drug me out of the time continuum and the flux of constant efficient causalities was getting that call for the hospital. It's a strange thing as a parish priest. Like, you can be doing whatever you want, and maybe you've got some free time all of a sudden, and so you're actually having friends over, making a meal, whatever, and that phone rings, and you're off to the hospital.
Yeah.
It happens a lot. And you have to. You have to drop what you're doing if someone's dying. And God forbid they die. Those moments are always so illustrative, were so illustrative for me, because I was so locked into the thing that I was doing and so appreciating family, friends, whatever it was. And it just all fades quickly when I'm there with someone.
It's disruptive.
Dying. Yeah.
It's disruptive for whatever you're doing.
You don't want to go. You don't know who the person is.
On a natural level.
On a natural level, you're like, what am
I? It's a nuisance.
Gosh, I finally got a moment with my friends or whatever. And then you go and you're like, I don't want to go back to the flow of whatever I was doing.
Yeah.
This is where life is. This is what's...
See, I always felt shame. So I felt so ashamed because it didn't matter. If I was woken up in the middle of the night, the only thing I could see in front of me is the disruption of a night's sleep, of being pulled out.
Oh, sure. We all do.
I never looked like a hero.
Well,
never.
No, I didn't
either. No. I'm not saying you did. But in the moment, I couldn't even muster it.
Yeah.
It took me to the moment I walked in the room.
That's it.
And that moment, like a ton of bricks and a tinge of shame, where you're like, oh, these poor people.
Loser, what were you
And then
complaining
I'm like,
about?
What was I thinking?
Yeah.
Like,
you're going to lose a little sleep?
Oh my gosh, these poor people. And then I always got home with my tail between my legs thinking, I'm such an idiot. But the thing is, I could never change it. I knew it. And I got to a point where I knew how I was feeling was going to be this, right? Because you do it so many times that you just know.
Yeah.
So you just push through it saying, I know, I'm an idiot. I'm short-sighted. Okay, here it is. I see now the big picture.
Yeah, you can't change it.
So the shame became less. But in the moment, it felt like really, you know, oh my gosh.
Well, that's a distinction, you know, that we should probably make insofar as, you know, the great French poet Marie Noël says, it's difficult to live as a human person because you're a composite being, like you're animal and you're rational. And so your animal nature has just got ends, right? It's got ends. And we don't really get a choice about wanting those ends. Mm-hmm. Just like the animals don't get a choice about anything.
Yeah.
We're this weird combination of animals that don't get a choice, but then an interior life that does have a choice. So I cannot not want sleep, food, sex, drink.
Right,
you know,
it's all right there.
It's all right there. Shelter, like this, all part of the inclinations of what every animal has. And they will pursue those things. They will go eat if they are hungry. And we can actually say no. And then there's that conflict that happens between us. So like what we're experiencing in those moments of being woken up for a sick call is in large part just the body. Just the animal nature saying, this is not right. I don't see any good that can come from this. There's no end out there because the animal nature doesn't know any end.
Right. So what you're saying is I'm a real animal when I wake up.
We all are. Well, especially when we wake up, right? Because reason's barely online.
I know.
The will is not engaged.
It's true.
All we have is the passions going running amok. This cannot be. You've all experienced it. How many times do you have the alarm go off and you hit it with the slight, Your intellect wakes up just enough to justify your reason for hitting it.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to wake up too much because then you're awake. But your reason gives you some reason to say, I don't need to be there. I don't need to be up for this reason. I will need this extra 10 minutes because of the appointment I have today or whatever the case might be.
Yep, yep.
It's amazing how clear
it is.
The mind becomes in like a half second of an alarm going off.
It is true. We don't really think about ourselves and, you know, our natures. yeah. and how they bear.
And it's composite, but it's still, we bear all the stuff that these poor animals have.
Oh yeah.
Just but it's all rational all the way down for us, except we're experiencing it.
But we have to, I mean, we have to account for it. It's important for us to account for it because then we know what's going on.
And then you feel a little less shame too.
About to say that. You could say, oh, right, this makes sense, right? I'm not the only one, or I'm not as much of a heel. Well, maybe a little bit, but not as much of a heel as I'm making myself out to be.
I have to say, in case any of us show up to your hospital bed, by the time we get to the room, we're good.
We're all in.
Don't feel as if we're
like, oh, Father, it's so hard. We put you out, you know?
No. This is what we do.
Right. It's kind of, I would imagine, very similar to like maybe a father who is helping a mom in the middle of the night to go feed a child or change diaper.
Yeah, and your body just says no.
And I would imagine even for moms, right? I just don't know what it's like to be a mom, so I can't
yes,
say.
Yes, you do.
Oh, don't you dare. But the thing is, I would imagine that's what it's like, right? You just, I'm sure there's a dad and a mom who could relate to all of those things. And the last thing you want to do, but you have to, is to get out of the bed and go to attend to your crying child, you know?
And, amen.
And it's the same sort of thing. I mean, you do, you're like, how could I not be here, right? How could I not do this?
Yeah.
You know, it just becomes so obvious, you know, the greater good that's involved.
Amen.
So, all right. Well, so before we go,
we mentioned before, we're sitting on this third floor overlooking this lake, and the sun is kind of popping through here and there, but for the most part, it's a cloudy day, but the kind of cloudy day where you see spots of blue and the sun peeks through and it's kind of light. Mm-hmm. And on the lake is so many different variations of light play, and corduroy rivers. And wind wisps and things of that nature. And it just got me thinking, probably at some point when you were talking, I was thinking about something else, which is just the nature of, it fascinates me that we have these different kinds of substances, that God would create something, you know, first of all, like water, which is so different than land. And I love that line in the scriptures where it says, God says to the waves, thus far and no farther, you proud waves. Like he confines it into places. And obviously when it bursts those bounds, we have all kinds of destruction, but the nature of it's being both placid and dangerous at the same time, so evocative and so mysterious. How could you come up with water?
I know.
And that's so cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I could tell you about some of its unique properties, but I'm sure you would not be interested.
Now, let me ask you this question. Is it true that to some degree, not completely, but to some degree, water is sort of conserved, right? Because if it evaporates, comes back down, evaporates, comes back down, over and over and over and over and over and over and over, right? So water molecules aren't necessarily breaking up. Is that correct?
Generally speaking, right.
Right. So it could be the case.
You can break it up.
It could be the case that a water molecule that fell off of our Lord's head in a rain.
Yes.
Could hit me.
Yes.
That's cool.
It also could be the case that the oxygen you're breathing passed through his lungs.
That's right.
Or the CO2 you're exhaling.
No, I just love that.
There's a little bit of some CO2 that's being generated by the body, so I don't want to, but we do exhale some of the nitrogen and things like that as well as we inhale it. And maybe that passed through the lungs of our Lord. Absolutely. But there are some really beautiful properties to water that are the result of hydrogen bonding that I won't go into.
Please don't go into.
But it does allow for animal life during winter underneath the ice, because those animals are...
True.
They are breathing in oxygen. So where does the oxygen come from when you have we don't have the exposure to the air above by way of a permeable membrane like the water? So how does that work? And so you have to have some oxygen flow. You have to have some water that because of its density, has to be able to drop at a certain temperature to bring oxygen down to the depths below. It has to cycle out of the solid state, the ice, go into the liquid state, and then new liquid becomes frozen. And it creates this whole cycle, a distribution of oxygen underneath the ice that wouldn't happen without this particular property of water. Which is really extraordinary to think
of. That is extraordinary.
So, but that's not my...
I was about to mock you, but what you're saying is so
fascinating. It is extraordinary.
So I'm not going to mock you.
I tried to stay from the wonky part.
I was just thinking about how much you're wasting oxygen right now.
I still remember some things. There's so many things I don't remember from my studies, but I still remember a few. But we were talking about waking up in the morning. And that made me think of how I wake up in the morning. And this past year, I returned to an alarm clock that I purchased about 20 years ago.
Mm.
It's called a Zen alarm clock.
I remember
now,
this.
Here we
thing.
Are.
You have the same, did you have the same
it's
one?
It's the same one.
Gotcha.
So it's very well made.
Boom.
So I had to do a small repair. I don't know if the note is an A or a C. I think it's an A or a C. I can't remember. But you set the alarm, and there's a chime bar, and there's this little, I don't know what to call it, little hammer, a soft hammer that hits the chime bar at the time in which you set the alarm. And it does this one note, and it just lingers and vibrates. And then 10 minutes later, it'll do it again. And then 5 minutes later, it'll do it again. And then 3 minutes later, then 1 minute later. Or maybe it's like...
So you're building in your snoozes.
Yeah, but you can get up at the first ding.
You can.
You can.
Have you ever?
It happens. I always say it's unheard of.
Okay.
At least I generally go for the second. But let me tell you, after the second, it's, you know, it goes pretty quickly. Like, it's pointless. But part of the reasoning for this type of alarm clock is that we could be in a deep sleep, and the jar of the traditional alarm of clanking metal or whatever nightmarish sounds we set for ourselves on our electronic phones and things like that, it is so unsettling that it doesn't admit for the real possibility of being awakened gently and slowly being pulled to the conscious world. It only admits for the possibility of being jarred. And your first moment is one of startle. And
yeah, this, I get it.
This is humane.
It's humane.
So I have to say, I just want to say, it's a new thing. I kind of like it. They're still making them actually out there. When they say Zen, they don't mean anything religious or Eastern in its philosophy or anything like that. It's just the brand name they came up with, maybe because they're
used
to those bells.
When I was a kid, I lived downstairs and my mother would get me up for school.
Yeah.
And she would always sort of open the door to the downstairs and holler down in dulcet tones. Not in a bad way. I shouldn't say holler.
Oh, that's nice.
She sort of sang down, you know, sang my name basically, and always very melodious.
See,
and
she
nice.
Was a natural Zen alarm.
And then, of course, I never got up because it was melodious.
But she's got to keep doing it.
And so 10 minutes later, that voice changed dramatically. Let's just say that.
So she lost the Zen.
Oh, she lost the Zen. The second time was like, there's hell coming down those stairs.
You know, with my father, it was always hell. Because he took, I think, a sinful delight in jarring all of us.
Yeah.
And jarring.
If I didn't get up, when my father would just walk in and say, get up. And if I didn't, the next time the light would go on and the mattress would be flipped.
So let's just cut to the chase and get up, right? You know.
Oh, well, everyone, have a blessed, blessed week.
Yes, of course.
Come, take care. Bye bye now. Makes me wanna scream. Thanks for listening to this episode of From the Rooftop.
For updates about new episodes, special guests, and exclusive deals for From the Rooftop listeners, sign up at rooftoppodcast.com.
And remember, for more great ways to deepen your faith, check out all the spiritual resources available at tanbooks.com.
And we'll see you again next time
from the rooftop.